In the wake of the 2008 financial collapse, Detroit, Michigan became America's iconic city of the global debt crisis. The once powerful industrial giant, the epicenter of America's car culture, the arsenal of democracy during World War II, and the source of musical inspiration through Motown, was crumbling. Corruption, racial tensions, the end of American dominance in the automotive marketplace, the global economic crash, and dozens of other factors all accelerated Detroit's decline. But one factor outweighed all the others. Political expediency and cowardice, combined with a willingness on Wall Street to encourage and profit from a completely unsustainable financial motto, had allowed the city's pension and health care debts to grow to Herculean size. When the crash came, this debt became a crushing weight on every aspect of civic governance. In his new book, Detroit Resurrected to Bankruptcy and Back, reporter Nathan Bomey delivers a narrative account of the legal and political battles to rescue the Motor City. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Nathan Bomey to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What brought you to this story and really being one of the first people to come to this story?
Well, I covered Detroit's bankruptcy for the Detroit Free Press, and it was a dynamic story of unbelievable personalities and personal consequences for so many different retirees and residents of the city and, of course, investors and museum people and philanthropists. So many people affected by the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history that I realized that the chance to write a book about the case and explain it for people who weren't necessarily following the day-to-day was just an opportunity I couldn't pass up.
When did you realize, as a reporter, that there were problems?
Well, you know, we realized going into 2013 that the city of Detroit was headed toward a fiscal calamity because the revenue was obviously collapsing, had been collapsing for decades, and the explosion of debt that occurred in the city of Detroit, when you look at those two factors, the collision of those two factors was leads to the inescapable conclusion that insolvency was going to happen, and the only question was, would the city delay the inevitable? Because bankruptcy, at the end of the day, was the solution to help the city of Detroit dig out of its financial crisis.
When you look at the city as a whole, the city had been doing poorly for quite some time. Is there one thing that you can look at to say, okay, this was a mistake that really caused this spiral?
No, I absolutely think there were a couple key mistakes, but the biggest mistake the city of Detroit made was borrowing $1.4 billion in the 2000s to fund its pension funds, because what they did was they locked in essentially 30 years worth of debt payments for something that really should have been a day-to-day obligation. And they also did some interest rate swaps, derivatives essentially, that basically ended up sinking the city budget. And, you know, UBS and Merrill Lynch, two global banks that signed on to that deal, ended up being significant creditors in Detroit's bankruptcy because of it. So they were ultimately one of the fiercest opponents of the city because the bond insurers that essentially had insured their debt were on the hook to make those payments when Detroit went broke.
The name of the book is Detroit Resurrected, and I do want to go forward just a little bit to bring us to the point where at what point was the resurrection to actually bring the city back?
I think that the fact that the city of Detroit used bankruptcy to put its people before its creditors for the first time, what they did was they actually shed $7 billion in debt through bankruptcy that essentially leaves them with about $1.7 billion over the next 10 years to invest in basic services like police, fire, and tearing down abandoned homes. These are things that most Americans take for granted. You know, 40% of the streetlights in Detroit were off before the bankruptcy. Now the streetlights are back on. A very simple example of some of the improvements that have occurred in the city. And again, maybe basic things, but things that the people of Detroit deserve. And without the shedding all that debt, it would not have been possible.
What was the reaction from the citizens of Detroit when that action was taken?
I think there was a lot of resentment at the bankruptcy at the beginning because people viewed the emergency manager of Detroit, Kevin Orr, who was appointed by the governor, as having usurped democracy in the city. And in many ways, they were absolutely correct. Democracy was suspended, and I find that to be a fascinating and in some ways poetic injustice, because you look at the arsenal of democracy. This was the arsenal of democracy. The Detroit helped preserve freedom for the world when World War II, by building, you know, tanks and weapons for the Allies. And to see the city devolve into a state of chaos, and where, you know, eventually the people of Detroit had sort of been left to fend for themselves, was really disturbing and disquieting. And so democracy was suspended, but you also have to ask yourself, what did the democracy get Detroit? You know, and did it fail? I think it causes us to ask ourselves some uncomfortable questions.
And you make this point in the book that there were really few winners here, but let's take retirees, for example. They were positive that their pension benefits would go away, and that wasn't the case. They ultimately got what in at some point what was coming to them, a better deal.
Yes.
Than was expected, at least.
That's absolutely right. You know, when the case started, there was a belief that there could be cuts of up to 50% for these vulnerable retirees who've been counting on these paychecks for their whole lives, of course, because they work so hard for them. And in the end, a group of nonprofit foundations, the state of Michigan, and the museum, the art museum in Detroit, they brought their donors together to basically bring a bunch of money and to lower the pension cuts that would have occurred otherwise, and then also to preserve the Detroit Institute of Arts from liquidation, because, believe it or not, the city of Detroit owned the museum, and had they not come up with some money to sort of stave off the possibility of a sale, we could have seen a liquidation of this world-class museum. So ultimately, it was a solution that helped the museum and the pensioners, and ended up preventing a big fight.
Rick Snyder is the governor of Michigan. You write about him in this book, and he comes off pretty good as being proactive and engaged, and quite frankly, very different than the governor that we read about in his actions toward Flint. Is that a fair assessment?
No, I think that is a fair assessment. I think that, you know, even the people of Michigan credit Governor Snyder with having done the right thing in Detroit's bankruptcy. In fact, the most recent poll I saw showed that he has the only thing that Michiganders are happy about with him right now is the way he's handled Detroit. Flint, on the other hand, of course, has been a total debacle. But, you know, I think there are actually some interesting comparisons you can draw here, because emergency managers were installed in both cities, but the emergency managers took substantially different directions with their involvement. In Detroit, you saw Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, lead in a very inclusive way, and he actually struck a Democratic consensus with almost all the major decisions he made, because I think he understood that long after he's gone, people of Detroit have to live with the decisions he's made. In Flint, however, you saw the city council, which never approved a switch to this Flint River water, and instead the emergency managers went ahead anyways. And, of course, we know the results, a humanitarian crisis. So, you know, if the emergency managers in Flint had actually led more cooperatively and struck a consensus, I wonder if we could have avoided this crisis altogether.
So how much of that is the structure and how much of that is Kevin Orr?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think Kevin Orr's leadership is maybe unique in some respects, because he had the power to really make the decisions unilaterally, but didn't necessarily deploy that power. And I think that that's a lesson in leadership in some ways, because, you know, the best leaders, you know, bring everyone with them. I've heard it said that a leader doesn't say go, the leader said let's go. And I think, you know, in some ways that's the way he led, because he made some tough decisions too. I think the decision to threaten the Detroit Institute of Arts with a sale, the decision to obviously pursue pension cuts, very controversial moves, but in the end, I think he understood those were going to become issues anyways. And I think if you look at Detroit's financial collapse, you know, the cities broke these promises to pensioners and debt holders, but I think those promises were broken many years before Kevin Orr came along. I think those promises were broken when the city of Detroit, you know, failed to make the tough decisions many years ago that would have protected those people.
I make this analogy a lot, but I think we often look for the good guy and the bad guy, the white hats versus the black hats. Your story is much more ambiguous than that.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I always think we as humans, it's very natural for us to look for the heroes and the villains. And, you know, it's not always that clear cut. And I think that Detroit's bankruptcy is very reflective of that. You had on one side Wall Street, which many people view as evil. You have on another side the retirees who maybe appear to be completely absolved of all responsibility. And I think on the other side you have the governor, who's certainly a controversial figure now, and many people who have very strong opinions about all the parties involved in this case. And I think what you see is that people made decisions for very good reasons in many cases that maybe were controversial, but they had a very good reason for doing what they did. Again, I go back to Kevin Orr threatening the Detroit Institute of Arts with a sale. That was very controversial at the time, but I think he understood that it was going to become an issue, and he simply was telling them, you need to get, you know, basically your ducks in a row because this is going to become an issue. And so sometimes, you know, in bankruptcy, people say things they don't mean and mean things they don't say. It's a very it's like a shadow boxing type of process where people are actors in some ways. And so ultimately the solution is what to look for. The process, a little bit messy, but the solution is what matters most.
So we look at this at a micro level in the book and very carefully of what's happening in Detroit. If we zoom out a bit and look more at the macro and say, okay, but what does this say about our nation as a whole when a major American city goes bankrupt?
Yeah, I think that the lessons for other cities are that, you know, don't let it get to a point where the promises that you've made you can't stick to. You know, I think the lesson is someday the bill will come due for people who, you know, for somebody, and someone will pay it. And that's what Detroit showed, is that, you know, by the time Detroit filed for bankruptcy, nobody was going to get 100% of what they were owed and what they deserved, because I don't think anyone would argue that pensioners deserve cuts. They certainly did not. They were promised things that they deserved. But what happens when the money runs out? What happens when the city can't pay? Because the judge in the case made a good point. He said, you know, the Constitution of the United States says only the federal government can print money. Cities and states can't do that. So they have a limited amount of money to actually spend, and when it runs out, someone will pay the price. So I think it's incumbent upon politicians and union officials and business leaders to basically have communities where we tell people the truth and we make pragmatic decisions and understand that there are certain levels of benefits and debt that we can afford, and it's responsible because we must protect the citizens first. Cities exist to protect the people and to preserve quality of life for their residents, and that's really the fundamental lesson of this case.
Is the resurrection, the post-bankruptcy resurrection, still a work in progress?
Absolutely. You certainly cannot say that Detroit was saved, because and that would be going too far, because I believe the city has a second chance at life. I don't necessarily think that the city's future is written yet. So I think that it's really up to the politicians now, the elected officials of Detroit, who are back in control of the city now, to make the decisions that are necessary to keep the city on the right track. The good news is that Detroit has a surplus now. Detroit's hiring police officers and investing in tearing down abandoned homes and obviously getting the streetlights back on and getting the bus system working. These basic things that it would have been extremely difficult to do without the bankruptcy. So that's the good news. But still, there are chronic issues in Detroit, like unemployment and the lack of good schools, which really the bankruptcy couldn't do anything about. And those are policy problems that are up to state and federal leaders to do something about.
The name of the book is Detroit Resurrected to Bankruptcy and Back. It is published by Norton. Nathan Bomey, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Loved it.
Great pleasure having you on the program. Nathan Bomey is a USA Today reporter living in Washington and was the lead reporter on Detroit's bankruptcy for the Detroit Free Press. Again, the name of the book is Detroit Resurrected. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.